Hello, friends, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. Thank you to everyone who said hi at Big Bad Con. I had so much fun. Space Station Phobolex and many sessions of For the Queen went super, super well, and I am honestly, like, kind of losing my mind waiting to share them with you. Both of them. Thank you, thank you, thank you to Big Bad Con, all of its organizers. Sean Nittner, I'm talking at you, for bringing me out. I really did feel like an honored guest. Big Bad Con, seriously, it's a beautiful time. Get out there if you can. Now, in just a few weekends, November 3rd, I will be on the opposite coast at one of my other all-time fave cons, Metatopia. I will be there in Morristown, New Jersey, playtesting a game called Little Town, a little live-action game that I'm co-designing with award-winning LARPwright Sean Roski. I'll also be doing some fun stuff with Bully Pulpit Games and their new version of Fiasco, and, you know, speaking on a panel about integrating safety and care into your game mechanics. You all know I love Metatopia, and you probably know by now that I will be very excited to see you if I see you there. You can find out more at dexposure.com. My guest today is Andrea Morales-Coteau, a design strategist who uses play to shift and expand social systems. She's starting to get into live-action game design, and then bringing those sensibilities into exciting new territory like crypto-economic systems. And also, she made a game for the Golden Cobra Challenge this year. Let's jump right in. Because I see game design in everything that you do.
Oh yeah, it is. Definitely is. If anything, that's my whole deal. How do I get game design into different spaces?
Right. But is it talking about the meta, like talking about your process behind that is less interesting for you?
I think it's not that it's less interesting, because I find game design in general and the meta and et cetera so interesting in and of themselves. But I think it has more to do with the level of proficiency, or rather how deep I can go with a person that's also a game designer in conversation, and a little bit of imposter syndrome in a way, right? I think when talking to a game designer, you can go deeper and deeper and deeper into what you mean by a level, or what you mean by, you know, this specific mechanism. And a lot of what I've learned talking to people like you, designers that are more in the LARP scene, has been that there's a lot of techniques and methods that I didn't know about before I came in. So that makes me a little bit uneasy, whereas talking to game designers that are in video games or that are in big games or even board games, I find a little bit easier. There's something that I see as very mystical about LARPing. It's kind of like a mystical creature to mm-hmm. me.
Right, because like when you lack like a really like depth of knowledge of how it works, and all of us do, like making LARPs, none of us really know 100% what's going to work. You kind of just like, that's why playtesting is so important. So there is this element of magic to it because its mechanisms are invisible.
Right. Well, there's that, but there's also, so thing that blew my mind. So I started LARPing at this point 3.5 years ago or something like that. And the first thing that blew my mind, I remember thinking about consent in design a lot before. And how do you build consent into things like products that may be digital or physical? And, you know, people would talk about things like affordances and stuff like that. And then about services, how do you build consent in services? Does that include, can go anything from being like, hey, here's one moment where you consent to doing something before starting the service or the experience, right? But then when I started LARPing, just the fact that you had different safety techniques, right? And then you can do your hand in this way or that way to indicate that things are going well. I was like, that was mind-blowing to me because I had never been in such an embodied space that, and such like a long-term, like you're designing for 2 hours up, right? And that's very different, you know. Even in services and products, you have one touch point. Like, say during the day, you look at your phone at a certain time, but you're not looking at your phone the whole time, right? In a LARP, sometimes you're like, we're going to play for 8 hours.
Yeah. And you're going to be in character and engaging with the material that you are also constantly co-creating.
Yes, it is completely different. And I think the closest that I had gotten to anything like that was when I acted in high school, you know. But as a designer, that blew my mind, and how you could use your body to indicate different dimensions from what's actually happening in the game and et cetera. It's very, very meta, very almost philosophical and sublime, mystical, as I said, in ways that I don't think any other design landscape I had been faced with is. So that's where I get a little bit, to go back and to circle back on this, I think that's where I get a little bit of like imposter syndrome, because there is something magical about that, you know, that I had never seen before.
And you're used to a certain level of understanding or a certain level of kind of intellectual mastery over the system.
Yes, 100%. So starting with the fact that and this is not popular, right? But I do see games as systems. Yes, they can be more than that. They can be experiences, etc. But the way I was used to treating them was as systems. And if anything, that was what allowed me to transition into this more design thinking realm, where I was designing for healthcare and designing for policy and doing all this other stuff in my career. The way I did it was by saying, hey, I think about games. Games are systems. Here's how I can think about your problem as a system, right? And bear in mind that before that, I was in digital storytelling, which was much more linear, right? I was doing transmedia and filmmaking. But when I made the switch, it was easier for me, not only for me, for everyone else too, to understand what I did when I said, games equal systems. Therefore, let me work on your systemic problem. And then LARPing is a system, but again, there's these different layers that are almost invisible and that flow into each other of meaning, that I guess you could say also happen in products and services, but that are more embodied. And that's different, right? Dancers are really good at that. For example, they can feel a concept in a dance, right? Whereas I think as a game designer, I was much more focused into putting things into words and rules and mechanics and dynamics, you know? So that, I guess that's why I get a little bit like, oh, I don't even know how to talk about this.
So this is interesting, because one of the things that I am baffled by, and I've never really had like a firm understanding of at all, is economics. And you were working on this project not too long ago, and I understand it may still be ongoing, about developing like a local crypto economic system that is like participant driven and like co-created and involves a lot of like very physical, tangible objects. I'm interested in just your interest in economics in general.
So that's interesting, because the moment you said that, I was like, yeah, my work has been pretty much about making the abstract not abstract. And just to take it back to the LARPing, in some ways, I think LARPing is more abstract. But anyway, again, this interest that I've had, and maybe it comes all the way back from storytelling, right? The way I've used storytelling all my life has been around making a feeling or someone's life experience into something that can be, perhaps consume is not the best way to describe it, experienced by someone else. and that's basically making meaning out of a person's experience, right? Making meaning for others. And when I became a designer, or when I decided to go down the path of becoming a designer instead of being a storyteller, I became interested in topics that I always liked. I like economics for some reason. I don't know why. Since I was a kid, I found them super interested. I was interested in, actually, this might make more sense, I was interested in how the systems of the world worked. And it seemed to me like economics didn't make much sense most of the time. One, they were hard to understand, but two, they weren't hard rules. So I thought there was probably something more in there than what I could even imagine was in there. So when I became a designer, I brought back things like economics and even play itself. And I decided to to really explore those and see how I can make them more understandable to myself, but also to others. In the process of that, that's when I came up with this idea for a system that would take a local currency from the Berkshires, which is in Massachusetts, called the Berkshares, and give them a way of competing with the bigger financial credit system. Mostly because of the following. If you look at the Berkshires from a macro point of view, they function as a sort of safety net for the people that live in the towns in the Berkshires. Because if the next financial crisis came in, if the system was widely adopted, meaning this local currency was widely adopted, they could then rely back on it. And again, that was, you know, partly looking at just finance as a game, which was the big deal behind my whole work, looking at finance as a game, but also looking at the game of the local currency itself and saying, how do people understand it? Can people even start playing it? Is it fun? Is it engaging? Without falling into gamification, which I think is a very different thing. And then from there, I said, well, you know, the way that I want this system that I believe in ideologically, right, this idea that we can have a safety net, that we can have alternative financial systems in the world, how can I make that more attractive? And through research, which is actually the equivalent of playtesting, right, I realized that one way of doing that could be really impactful was making an infrastructure that had these playful objects that would connect to each other and show how the economy, the abstract, was actually alive and functioning in the town.
Right. In a very like present and kind of tangible way. I'm going to have a link to your write-up of the project in the show notes. I totally encourage everyone to go check it out. But just to make it a little more concrete here on the show, so people had these tokens that were functionally similar to credit cards, but also very different. Can you explain those differences a bit more?
Yeah, there were a few differences. One, they would light up in different ways according to how much money you had left. And two, and I never got to do this, but now I actually am at where I work, interestingly enough. I wanted to make them so that they could interact with each other. And eventually you could see a sort of, through these tokens that look like little wooden pieces. They're actually really cute. They had a little tag inside of them, an electronic tag, an RFID. And they could connect to each other and interact with each other. So you could give people money or take money from people. And also, if enough people got together in a single place, you could make decisions about how the economy was working. So for example, allow someone else to come into the community and get a token, or kick someone out, or think about new different ways that you could distribute money, right? So the whole idea was, how do we make a game out of this social tissue that is money and finance?
Right. So the idea is that you have, if you have like a quorum, basically, of these little kind of hex-shaped tokens that everyone has, then you could like do like voting on things and make decisions about things and alter the system directly.
Yeah. And you know, I guess at the end of the day, it has to do with this idea that if given the chance, I believe game designers could make really, really complex social or societal topics and problems more palatable for everyone. And that there is good in that, right? That there is good, an essential good in bringing these topics that are very kind of like intellectual or hard to understand, sometimes made hard to understand on purpose, make them more of a thing that we can all take back.
And this is something that sounds like it's very meaningful for you, this idea of a resilient and just economic system.
Yeah, I mean, it actually, interestingly enough, started when I was in grad school. I came to New York and I did a master's at Parsons. And while I was there, let me give you some background. While I was in Parsons, what I was studying was, as I told you, this thing called design thinking, or it was like a broader way of looking at design. And the whole idea was, hey, you can use design for bigger systemic problems that society is going through. Here's how, right? So they would teach us different ways of doing that. One of them was systems thinking, and then I could choose what else I wanted to do. And I did game design because I was obsessed and I loved it. But also, because I was obsessed with game designers. I love game designers. I think they're the most brilliant people in the world. And yeah, I obsessed with designers. And so I remember while I was at school noticing that the space I was in, the industry I was in inside design, was very willing to hire me, right? They're like, yes, you can go work with, you know, back then the White House, or you can work with the UN, or you can work in this thing and that thing, right? And it was an exciting space to be in. But then when you looked at my friends that were game designers, many of them were going through very simple questions like, how do I sell a game on Steam that is not a dollar, right? How do I deal with all of these economic problems around value and around the value of art in general? And that generated a bit of a dissonance in me because I felt really good about my work and I was being rewarded for being like, hey, I'm a game designer, I bring this to you. Whereas my friends that were actually game designers had not so good prospects. So I started thinking about that, and I had been into economics, as I told you. At some point, I even thought about it when I was a kid. I was like, oh, I want to grow up to be an economist, which is the weirdest thing ever.
It's very adorable.
Yeah, I was like, can't wait. Specifically, I was into macroeconomics, so there's that. And so I was like, I really want to do that. But I brought it back in this moment when I was thinking about, I don't really understand digitally how value is even created, you know, and I couldn't wrap my head around it. And so I brought it back from being a kid, and my professors actually told me, hey, why don't you, because I started by looking very specifically at video games, and they told me, hey, why don't you start thinking about, in general, the design of value, which is, you know, the biggest question that a professor could ask you. Please redesign value for, you know, modern Western society. And I was like, well, okay, I'll try. And across that, or while coming across that and trying to tackle that, I became really passionate about it because I realized that there was an incipient community of artists and game designers too that were really into thinking about finance and creating new ways of inserting games into finance. So that's where, and I realized that right there, this is the perfect thing for me because it just mixed everything I loved.
And so you've continued to follow that passion into a lot of different projects.
Yeah, so that has been quite a trip. So the first one was the project that you mentioned. I actually started that in grad school. So I did that with the Shoemaker Institute for New Economics. Then after that, I got hired by ThoughtWorks, which is a technology consultancy. And in there, I was actually working on big systemic problems, also from the point of view of games, but mostly working with NGOs and in general social movements, mostly based in the United States, trying to help them find the right levers for making social change happen. I was there for 2 years. I was mostly focusing, like I said, on systems thinking and how to get that as a practice into all these social movements. And then after that, so that was 2 years, I think I mentioned it, but after that, I got hired into Consensus, which is a venture studio based in Brooklyn for Ethereum, which is a kind of cryptocurrency, which is already going to be hard enough to explain, but yes, it's a kind of cryptocurrency. Type of blockchain.
Cool. I don't really understand either of those words, but you know, maybe an avenue into that could be, how do you as a game designer contribute to that? How are you valued there and what do you do?
Oh, it's been pretty cool actually, because they've gotten really, really excited about it to the point that I was recently named the lead strategist of the game design practice inside Consensus.
Ooh, hell yeah.
Hell yeah, right? That's so exciting. Okay, so there are several ways that I've been making this happen. The first one has been just implementing playtesting and the idea of making digital systems that we have into analog versions that can be understood by people. So most of the systems that we create, not all of them, but most of them, are actually games in disguise, right? What they have is tokens, points, mechanics, dynamics, etc. And I know, again, not all games are like this, right? But I'm going to talk about specifically systemic games, not narrative games. We don't have many of those. Although we do have some, by the way. We have Solarius, which is a distributed narrative game. So that's pretty interesting. But most of the games that we have that have some way of being quantified are all online and are done by developers that don't necessarily have a background in either design or game design or social sciences. So what ends up happening is they make these really complex games that are very like first generation board game kind of games, right? They are not fair. They are really excruciating. They are not aiming for everyone to be happy. They're aiming for someone to win, right? There's not much emphasis on how people get to winning, which is, by the way, in these games, equivalent of making money, which is already, you know, misguided. But yeah, winning is making money. And the way that you make money is usually very ruthless and driven by greed. Many of these developers think that the motivation for most people to engage in these sort of like community games is greed, which goes contrary to most of which I know as a game designer. So what I've done is taken these digital games that are already done, because there's a lot of legacy there, even though it's a new technology, there's a lot of legacy. And I tell them, hey, how about we try your game or we try your product, right, in an analog version? Let's make it into a board game, or let's make it into a LARP. This actually happened. And we'll see how it goes. And I want to see how people feel about it. And I want to see how much people are enjoying it or not, and what's wrong with it. And so that has been a first thing that I've done as a game designer. And the results have been, first of all, mind-blowing to them, right? They're like, oh, wow, we should be thinking about how to create community, and we should be thinking about fairness, and we should be thinking about system balancing. And I'm like, yeah, it's a thing. But two, they've also been saying, hey, how do we make our digital games more like these? Which has been so satisfying.
Do you have any answers to that?
We're starting out. So the first one that I've been telling them is, so I'll give you an example. They have these almost like persistent games where there are no specific times for communities to come together. And a big thing with game design period is having a magic circle, right? And all of us agreeing to play for a certain amount of time and being able to accommodate our lives to that. The games that they make don't do that. So when I make a board game, I inherently have to do that. So one of the things that we've been looking into is how do we make specific times and rituals for going into the game, right? More than just clicking on a URL and being like, haha, I'm in the game now. Rather, how do you come in, right? How do you create the equivalent of a loading screen in this human context? How do you create consent, playing into what's going to happen, right? And for them, very much like HQ Trivia, I don't know if you've played it, but one of the things that they've been saying, and I don't know if this is the best solution, but it's an example of the evolution in thinking that the developers have had, has been, hey, what if we had specific moments when people come together to make these economic decisions together? Oh, I already said that. To make these economic decisions.
Like a town hall.
Yes. So another thing that I've been encouraging for them, you know, encouraging them to do has been, could you please look at community organizing as another part of what you do, which I also think game design takes a lot from, and usually a lot of activists are game designers. So we've been looking into that too. And that's just one example, but what we're actually going to try to start doing is literally taking these games that are analog and transforming them into a platform that could really help that game happen. So that has been the new challenge.
Right. How do you translate the benefits of how people interact face-to-face and try to get some of that value in an artificial environment?
Exactly. At least until we can understand what is native to an artificial environment, which I think the web has been doing. There's this really cool, I always forget, it's a visual essay and I can send you the URL, but there's this visual essay where there's an explanation of how, for example, plastic went from initially replicating natural materials like wood, because people otherwise wouldn't use it. And it wasn't until decades later that people started using plastic for its own, consistency and its own flexibility and its shine. And now humans are pretty much used to it.
So this is like, it makes me think of Second Life, right? It makes me think of attempts to imitate the real world on the web, which were very popular, but also Maybe this explains why they were also so profoundly short-lived.
Right, because they lacked a deeper understanding of the affordances of this new media, right? And so in Consensus, what I'm working on is, one, onboarding people into these big, what they are is big serious games, you know? And serious games that can affect, I'll give you an example. There's this one called Civil that's all about rethinking the business model of journalism. And it's kind of like a big, huge co-op of many newsrooms that has a token so that they have their own economy where they only reward what is quote unquote good behavior in that economy. And each of us readers get to contribute to that economy or pay kind of like for the whole co-op to exist. It's crazy, right? It's a new way of doing things beyond borders, beyond jurisdictions. And to me, that is a huge, serious game. And not only to me, many other people inside Consensus are thinking about it this way now. Because, not because they're necessarily serious games, but rather because it's the only digital analog, well, digital example that we can think of, right? Who else has been doing this sort of community work in such a specialized way with an economic component to it? It's usually video games, right? And I would posit, or the way I have been framing it is, it's usually video games, but not only that, video games always look to board games and LARPing and et cetera for true mechanic innovation, because that's the most abstract level, right?
You emphasize over and over again, like, really collaborative models and cooperative models, democratization in certain ways. What does participatory design mean to you? Why are you drawn to it?
Well, I think it comes from being a game designer, first and foremost, and understanding that the way games work now, or most games work now, there has to be something for everyone to stay engaged, right? And out of that engagement, out of all of us playing and feeling like there is a reason for us being there, the game as a whole is better. And you have a higher chance of recommending it to other people and of bringing other people into this community of games that you're creating, right? And so that understanding, which is in a really small scale, has translated into all the work that I do. Out of the simple understanding, and I could be wrong, but this is my hypothesis, that if I keep everything I do participatory and I bring in people and make sure that what I'm designing makes them happy too, then these big economics experiments that we're going to have are always going to remain a source of joy for people and are always going to remain understandable and are always going to remain engaging. And the importance of that is that if you look at humans, when we think about things in big scales, so like macroeconomics, it's really hard for us to understand, one, how it relates to me, but also two, how people being left out of it or harmed by it affects me, right? So those are like two components that are related to each other. When you're in these games that are like the ones I've told you about, like the Civil one, or just in general games that are more like economic and that seem to be like these big serious games on the blockchain, if a user or a person, a player, I like calling them players, but usually I say user, if a player does not want to be a part of the game, they can just leave, right? Which is different than the real world, quote unquote, where if a person is poor or is being disenfranchised, they can't leave the world, right? They're not ejected from the world. They stay, we just stop seeing them. So the scale is big enough. It's sad, right? I'm not saying it's good. If anything, it's sad. The scale is big enough that you can forget about these people. But here's the advantage. In this small scale, I can make damn sure that everyone sees that and that it affects the system. That's really cool, right? And I don't mean from a God mode kind of way, but more from a how do you make sure that a community is healthy? And when you're in that small scale, no one can avoid, almost beyond politics, no one can avoid the fact that having people get out of your system or feel disenfranchised in it ends up affecting everyone.
Yeah, that it's real for you, whether or not you want to acknowledge it.
Yeah, because it's there, right? It's digital. The feedback loops are there. You can actually feel people leaving, feel people coming in. You can see the numbers. You can see the threads. You can see, right? So there's this cool thing that I currently can't do in the world because the world is too big, but I can do it here. So I think participation becomes important, you know, on a practical level, but it's also important for me to make a point about what I believe in the world.
And making something that lines up with your values, that you can express a value through.
Yeah. And interestingly, some economists would say no, but interestingly enough, it can even prove things beyond my values, right? I can say without a doubt that this economic system didn't work because the people that had less money in it were not catered to and didn't feel a way to compete with the people that had a lot of money in it. So what ended up happening is they left, and then the economy as a whole suffered. I can say that, right? And so it cannot only appeal to what I believe in, but it can say, look, here it is. It's pretty simple. There was no other reason. You can point to it. You can feel that pain and see it transform into something that affects the whole system. That's as cool as it gets from a systems thinking point of view for me to be able to say the feedback loops are there. You can't deny them. It's not a question of where I lie politically, right? Even though I'm pretty clear about my politics, but yes.
Yeah, I mean, you can be explicit about what you're saying, but then also, you know, point to realities. This brings me back actually to the Berkshires project and just the idea of a smaller system being more resilient or being more flexible or something. I mean, speaking to me as someone who doesn't really understand economics, is a smaller system inherently more resilient or more just?
So, wow. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know if it's more just. Actually, one of the things that I've always freaked out about is when I think about my ideal world, and this will be changing, but when I think about my ideal world, I would like a world where all communities can self-organize into little co-ops where labor is distributed and compensated according to what the community thinks is the most important. And there would be some sort of way, maybe like a macro token or something like that, to keep most prices stable. But there would be enough technological and societal freedom for people to self-organize in this way. And if you look at things like slime mold or mycelia, which are like the examples of emergence and the examples of self-organization in nature, that can happen. That happens. We just don't know how, right? We're still trying to figure out biologically how that happens, but that can happen, right? I even have this, by the way, this is not at all scientifically proven in any way, but I even have this theory that humans are starting to unconsciously freak out about climate change, and that this is why, like, the world is, because of climate change, you know, we've had different migrations, that plus wars, of course, but because of climate change, we're looking at, you know, more wars, and that leads to more migrations, and that leads to, you know, depletion of resources, and so on and so forth, and cultural clashes. And my theory is that the reason that the world is so freaking polarized right now has to do with this sort of like unconscious panic about climate change. But beyond that, if humans actually did have that, we don't know how to tap into it yet.
This mycelial capability.
Yes. And I do think we must have it because we belong to nature, right? But, you know, how that happens, we don't know. In theory, if we had something like that, the system would be just and the system would do the appropriate functions or tasks to survive in the best way. But that's not what happens, right? And so, or it isn't currently what is happening because we would have reacted to climate change by now, right, as an example. So is it always just to make smaller systems that interconnect with each other? I would say in the cases of most natural systems, yes. In the cases of humanity, I'm not quite sure. So even though I have this utopia in my head where people are able to self-organize in this way, There are problems like, and this is the biggest one, if there is a Nazi self-organizing community, do we let them self-organize? Do we not? And why and how? And that's usually when things break down. And I don't have answers to it either, because my sense would be we wouldn't force those kind of things to not happen. But it's hard, you know, at the same time, like, how do you actually design for those things? So I don't know if it's more just, but what I can tell is that it's easier for humans to understand, and at least it gives you a little bit more agency, right? It's different to have 10 people against you than to have a society of 3 million against you, or 5 or 10. So,
and I think that agency is part of this sort of cultural freak out, because I think not only are there, you know, problems, but also people's capacity to be aware of them, and even a very slight capacity to understand what causes them, is expanding, but not at the same rate as our ability to solve those problems, right? And so when not only are you faced with, you know, severe, horrible things constantly, right? That's shoved down your throat by our ability to do mass media and things like that. There's not a corresponding way to, like, fix that. And I don't know if that second part is possible. I know we can do bad things and we can make each other extremely hyper aware of them, but I don't know if we can, like, fix things at the same scale, which doesn't make any sense, right? Because if we can harm things at that scale, why can't we
fix them? Yeah. And it also relates a little bit to emergent behaviors in games, which I think, to bring it back to LARP, the reason I'm fascinated by it, and I said mystical, but in hindsight, I also mean the ability for these game designers to create a sandbox for emergent behaviors, right? One thing that I've seen a lot in games design for live action role playing is this idea of you put in just the rails. You don't build the whole train because then no one wants to play. People want to bring in their whole idea of what a character is. They want to tap into imagination. They want to react from what another person is doing. They want this emergent storytelling to come in. And yes, people get better at it, right? Some people get better at prompting others to do things. That's why usually you have, you know, experts in the group playing in a certain way and trying to prompt others towards interesting changes in the narrative. But doing that and creating that emergence is very magical. And the reason I think that that can happen is because it is being tailored exclusively to humans. The technology is none other than language. That's brilliant, you know, because that's the most emergent technology we've come up with, language. And, you know, it's a technology that can change, that can adapt, that, you know, you can create new words, you can create new spaces, and no one needs to vet this. You don't need to connect it to the internet. There's no electricity involved, right? And so to me, LARP designers are designers of emergence, and that's something that I've been wanting to understand more and more and more. Because in other spaces like video games, I was reading about Slime Rancher, actually watching a video about Slime Rancher, a game that I've never played. I gotta play. But the main designer was talking about designing emergent storytelling in video games. And to him, it was creating these sort of NPCs, the slimes themselves, to have wants and needs that are in constant conflict. And then gamers, players, would look at slimes doing things that, you know, collide at wants and needs, and they in their heads would come up with reasons that that was happening and be like, oh my god, this slime just piled up and jumped over this fence to get the food. But in reality, what was happening was slimes want food, but they will pile up anytime they're close to each other. They're not piling up to get food. They were just piling up already, and then one of them jumped, they could.
But we project meaning and intent onto everything.
Yes. So that kind of emergence I find interesting, because it's emergence and constraint, right? It's, well, the tech allows me to do this. But the kind of emergence that you make in LARPing is completely different. It's all natural, right? It's people creating inside their own heads, you know, wants and needs, and they're not even coding them, right? I find that fascinating. And I'm always trying to understand why a designer did more or less constraints on what was happening, right? And usually we say, oh, we're optimizing for fun. But I also think we're optimizing for something different, right? Because fun in all games, but I think in LARPs specifically, can be super sad stuff, you know, and we still engage in it. Whereas I feel like in video games and board games, you're usually more like, fun is cheerful feeling, right? I think LARP designers don't always think that. And I find that fascinating. Just the evolution of that goes so fast because all you're dealing with is words. So you can change what game design means in days, you know?
And so much like of language is nonverbal, right? And that's why gestures and body position and even position in a space can become these really, really like charged communicative like symbols when you're doing live action play. Because it's, you're right, it's for the most part kind of all you have.
Yeah, and it's your instinctive programming language.
Yeah, yeah, it's your base code stuff, yeah.
It's your base code as being a human, and we still haven't even figured out how that works, right? We still don't know a lot about neurons and basic brain functioning. So there's a whole bunch of stuff in there that I'm fascinated by because there's designers working with brains and reality as their main design media, right? They're like, hey, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to design for reality. And then saying, also, not only am I going to design for it, but I'm going to design and with concepts that I even myself don't understand completely. Like, how does the human brain work? I don't know, but I feel this way, right? My playtesters told me this. So this is what I infer from that.
So there's all these kind of leaps of faith and just intuitive responses to design. Because you're like, this works. I don't know why. Frankly, it's not super relevant for me to know why. As where if you're working with something that is artificial, in the sense that it is an artifice, right? Something that is made. You can track why, right? Like anyone who's made a digital game has known the process of bug hunting and you know, why did this not work? Or why is this happening? But yeah, when all you have is something that we fundamentally don't understand, I guess that is kind of a scary design space, isn't it?
It is. It 100% is. That's why I keep saying magic and mystical and magicians, because I do think it's the purest design that I've seen other than, I don't know, like storytelling itself, right? That's why they're so linked too, I think. But if you look at industrial design, right? You have, again, a physical object. If you look at product design and web design, you have a thing that you're designing for. If you look at production design in filmmaking, same. Like, you can keep going and be like, yeah, they're dealing with something physical. And, of course, there are LARPs that have things that are physical, and usually you rely a little bit on it, even if it's just a flashcard, right? But there's something incredible about this group of designers coming together and just designing reality. You know, that's it. That's everything. There's nothing else. Even in StarCross, I think, yeah, not to plug in your own game, but I think even in StarCross, you're doing that in essence because you could not have the Jenga tower and have people, I mean, it adds a lot to it, right? Because physics allow this idea of it can fall on its own, right? But eventually, most of the tension that is happening between two people and how they react to each other, how they look at each other.
Oh my God, right? You're making me want to play a game without the tower. No tower, star-crossed. What would happen? That would be amazing.
That would be really cool. And see what happens. Like, at what point does it break or does it not?
We'll have to do that next time we're hanging out.
Yeah, I would love that. That would be super cool. Super intense, yeah. Too. I'd be like, okay, I'm done. Because your game is intense.
It sure is. It sure is. But
it achieves what it wants.
That's right. I always get what I want. But speaking of plugging people's games, I think, you know, you've been talking about LARP design as though it's something that you don't do and haven't done, which is kind of endearing. I would really, really like to talk to you a bit about the game that you just submitted to the Golden Cobra Challenge, which everyone should go check out and get very excited for the end of, yeah, the reveal. This game called The Torch, which I understand is very personally meaningful to you.
Yeah, so this is the first time. I mean, if you look at my past work, right, and you look at all the games I've done, as we've said, there's something about it dealing with emergence, dealing with game design, etc. But I've always had a very specific medium. This also reminds me that Torch has also like a physical object, so that's interesting. Maybe I didn't go all the way. But Torch is the first time that I've created a LARP in itself. It's more of a narrative game. And I created it out of a need to go into this full-heartedly, you know. So September 15 or around September 15 is usually when most Central American countries, I'm from Costa Rica, when most Central American countries celebrate independence. And interestingly enough, Central America was gifted independence. It's not that simple, of course, but it was given independence through a written message from Spain because Spain couldn't support us anymore, right? Spain was going down, they were not making money, they were in debt, and they were like, you know what, you get to be free, which is very different from many stories around the world when it comes to colonization. And the whole game is about what it means to be a part of a nation and whether you can keep that torch of independence going. And I was more interested in this idea of humans being perishable and whether or not us humans having an expiration date affects the way we build nations or the way we build communities and collectives. So in Torch, you use a flashlight as the torch itself, and you get to say different stories about each anniversary of the torch coming back after the first year. And you can end at any point that you want to. And there's some suggestions as to what makes a story good, because each person gets to tell a story. But the whole idea is to create this almost ethereal expression of community and nations. And when you leave the game, hopefully you're actually feeling a little bit useless, but in a beautiful way. So, you know, because there's nothing wrong in maybe not building anything. But there's also something wrong with it too, right? We're always caught in history and the idea of, you know, what am I leaving? What am I actually having here or not? So that's what I wanted to go for.
I remember when this idea of the torch came to you as kind of centralizing object. Were there any games that inspired you in terms of how the game is structured? Because I was just taking a look at it and it's got this it really feels like a Golden Cobra game in a good way. You know, where it's like 3 pages long, there's some cool illustrations. I figured. And it's very much like, just do this. I'm not going to explain why. Like, this is, you know, like it does not, that is not a game that gets into the history of Costa Rica. It's just like, here, go have this experience, perform these actions, and then tell me how you feel.
Yeah, I talked about that with some first playtesters because some people were saying, oh, I thought there was going to be more of a visualization of colonization and what that feels like. And honestly, as a person that's from Costa Rica, my whole thing came from I don't want people to feel restricted by negative feelings about their current countries. So I didn't want to use this as a way for me to, I don't know, to make people feel like they're a part of Central America or make people feel like they owe something to Central America. And I mean by this, like, you know, the North, quote unquote. It was more about the actual universal human condition and me moving from Costa Rica to New York. I'm an example of that, right? Of this idea of what is home. What do I leave? What nation do I belong to? What is a nation? Should there be nations? And just a reflection upon how at home I felt sometimes in a nation where, you know, ironically, we all spoke the same language, right? And we were all Catholics and we're ethnically very mixed. But to the point where, for example, people ask me where I'm from and I'm like, Costa Rica. Like, I don't really know anything about my great great grandparents or something like that. I don't know where they came from. I think people in the United States, and I don't know about Canada, but the United States, they tend to know more of that. My country is definitely a country of immigrants. We just don't know where we come from, right? And there's something sad about that, but there's also something weirdly liberating. And so I wanted people to be able to build whatever they wanted in that context and kind of like provide a moment to just have a sublime experience that doesn't necessarily make you feel burdened by the world, but it could, right? There's some words in there like your nation feels bloodlust. That could be a choice you make. But, you know, hopefully people that are playing the game will already be channeling their own backgrounds into it without me being like, hey, P.S., remember that colonization sucks. Like, I'm like, well, that's pretty, I think, straightforward if you play the game.
And you're also not giving what I assume are at least partially white Americans the experience of a story about colonization that they want. And that seems good.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, in my head, actually, when I came up with it, I initially started writing it in Spanish because I thought this would be beautiful for people in Costa Rica to play. Because my country's super divided right now. Well, I guess America is too, but Costa Rica's super divided. We just went through elections. We had two different presidential candidates. One was super conservative and evangelical and homophobic, and the other one was progressive and kind of like, you know, like neoliberal in a way. And so there were like these two sides that are not really even sides, and politics are getting so confusing in the world, right? And I just thought, wouldn't it be beautiful to have people think about a different past and future for our country than the one that we have currently? What would come up, what would they come up with? And so originally I actually had a lot of, there were songs per each round of storytelling that were made by a Costa Rican group. I took those off just because it was really hard to do when you're playing and I'm not there. But that's where it came from. And I decided to make it into English because I thought the symbolism of the torch in itself is beautiful enough and people can relate to. If you look at the Olympics and stuff like that, it's already generating a certain sense of identification. Like you can identify with it. And then you have all the whole like Plato's cave and, you know, so on and so forth that you can think about. But I wasn't going for that.
All the way back to Oedipus.
Yeah. I wasn't going that deep, you know? Prometheus and stuff. Yes. Why not?
I think it's extremely okay, and in fact, in my opinion, ideal, to center icons and symbols that don't have a direct word-for-word meaning. Because if they had word meanings, why wouldn't you just use words?
Right. Exactly. So that's why I took the history part out of it. It's, you know, let's start with the fact that apparently the torch didn't even exist. Like, there's myths about it. So why would I?
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah. Why would I, like, even position it as a thing that actually happened in Central America so that people will start thinking of themselves as, like, brown people in Central America? I'm like, no, actually, if anything, I'd be excited if someone was like, oh, we're starting this and it's year 2300 in the new Republic of Cats. And, you know,
yeah.
And we're all cats and we got our independence. Like, why not? You know, I find that super exciting. I wish someone would do that.
Right. Because you're telling a story about a broader political things, but also a personal thing. And I love that you tied it into this existential dread, like of just the finiteness of your own life kind of, and how that plays into how you think you should be bound to and interact with other people.
Yeah. Cause that's a humbling thing. Right. And I like I like being humbled by my own existence and my death. No, but really though, I do like thinking about what unites me to others and what doesn't. And I find it really hard. I mean, I guess this could happen, but I would find it really hard for someone to play this and just be a complete asshole. Because you're telling other people's stories about yourself. Like, just that on its own, or yourself as a character. So you're doing empathy with a character that you're creating. And the character could be an asshole, you know, in themselves. But then you're telling it to other people. So you probably want other people to empathize with your character, right? So there's just no way that you're going to create a complete asshole. It's just really hard for a human to do that.
And all we can do is dissuade and discourage and make things difficult.
Yeah. Exactly. So other people inside the room would just be like, all right, and just ignore that story, you know, which they're also open to doing.
Right.
So, you know, that's where it came from. And I think there's also some other themes in there around the idea of independence and control. And I think those are much more personal. And I was talking about them recently with my therapist, and then I told him about the game. And he looked at me like, oh, that's interesting. And I was like, no, why?
Yeah, you don't get it.
I guess it is about that, but let's not talk about it. But there is a level of just me. I've been thinking a lot about who I am, where I belong, and this idea of with more immigration internationally, where do all of us belong to? And it's this great prototyping of humans. That's what we're doing right now. It's like the great prototypes of human civilization. Is it gonna withstand people that don't feel like they belong anywhere completely? Is it about making it even more local? Am I a New Yorker instead of a Costa Rican or an American or whatever it is? Is it more than I'm a human being, period? And how do I compare that with my upbringing, which was in a country where I felt almost oblivious of who I was, right? I was just a Costa Rican and a woman. I think that part was really important. But from an ethnicity point of view, it's really hard for me to see the details of it. And one, it's, you know, because I'm super white passing. So yeah, of course, looking back, I'm like, oh, right. I had a lot of privilege. But also, you know, people in Costa Rica are Costa Ricans. That's pretty much it. There's more to it than that. I don't want to be simplistic.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. But this is also just an interesting concept to me. Like, I live in Canada, right? It's a country that is the product of an ongoing genocide of Aboriginal peoples. And like, it's so hard for me to think of nation as a good thing. Like for me to associate positive things with that concept. And then especially when nationalism for me, I associate with like profoundly negative things. So when I talk to talking to you now, talking to people from, you know, a place like Finland, talking to someone from Palestine not too long ago, like, the idea of nationhood as something that is still relevant as a political concept and an identity concept in a unifying and positive and empowering way, it's just kind of an interesting thing to be reminded of.
To many people, it is. And in Torch, the whole idea behind each person is saying a little story that's a snapshot in someone's life inside this nation is actually the idea that there is no such thing as one nation, while at the same time wondering if there is, right? And I don't have solutions, but what I can tell you is there was a certain type of comfort in knowing where I came from. And there's this song in Costa Rica that says, like, sometimes I look back, but it's only to know where I came from, by Mal País, which is this national group that everyone loves. And I'm pretty sure not all Costa Ricans feel that way, right? Black Costa Ricans have had a hard time, etc. But even then, everyone is Costa Rican. It was more about speaking Spanish in a certain way, knowing the right song, you know, having the right accent. That's where it starts getting tricky, you know? But there was some sort of comfort in being like, we all have this shared language. It's here. And when I moved out, I've had to contend with, what were the good parts about that? What were the terrible parts about that? Was it always terrible? And I'm just thinking about it in hindsight, right? Which is possible too. And in the game, I go more for, I don't think there's one answer. So I'm just going to have everyone talk about it and figure it out for me, because that would be nice.
That's the best thing about making a game, is that you can just pose these unanswerable questions that you've been struggling with and be like, okay, folks, let me know.
Well, you can do that in LARP.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess video games do that too. But I think there's much more space for a lot of answers in LARPs.
Answers, yeah.
Right. Because it's such a flexible medium that you can just see how people are taking it and doing emergent things with it. So that's why I did that. And hopefully someone will answer it for me, or I'll figure out new stuff.
Get something. Well, I'm very, very glad that you've decided to jump in after doing all these huge, amazing projects to write a simple little kind of free-formy storytelling live-action game. People will be able to find that in the beginning of November once the Golden Cobra games are up on their website. But if people just want to keep up with you and the stuff that you're doing and publishing, and if they want to work with you, where should they go?
Yeah, so I have a main site, which is www.com. Andrea, because that's my full name, Morales Cotto, C-O-T-O, AndreaMoralesCotto.com. Inside of there, there's my Twitter and et cetera, because my Twitter's in Spanish, so I'm not even going to say it right now. And yeah, you can keep up with me. Please get in touch with me. I love talking to new people. And I'd love for all of you to play my game.
Yay. All right. Well, yeah, thank you so much for joining us. This was super fun.
No, thank you, Alex. This was great. Seriously.
Thanks again to Andy for joining us, and as always, thank you for listening. If you have thoughts on today's episode, you can always email backstorypodcast@gmail.com or follow @backstorycast on Twitter and chat with me there. Backstory is hosted by yours truly and produced by the talented Alex Sisk. Let me know if you need a good editor. We are part of the One Shot Podcast Network, along with a bunch of other awesome role-playing related podcasts like System Mastery. System Mastery is a delightful stroll through the history of role-playing games, except the games are bad, and the hosts are total jerks about everything. But it's really fun and really funny. Join hosts Jeff and John as they explore the weirdest games ever made to talk about what worked, what went wrong, and which Silverhawk was the best. It was Hot Wing. Find their shows at SystemMasteryPodcast.com. Music for Backstory is provided by Ujiko. The track is called Thinking of You, and you can hear more by finding UJICO on Bandcamp, Spotify, SoundCloud, YouTube, and wherever else you get your chill beats. Talk to you later, friends.